This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Julian Ng, Sharad Kutan, and me, Melissa Idris. Ibrahim Sani is speaking to our Breakfast Grill guest at the moment, Tan Sri Shahrir Samad, the chairman of the BN Backbenchers Club. He's also the MP for Johor Bahru.
You know, we're doing a little experiment. You're going to be able to watch The Breakfast Grill. I mean, watch it, not just listen to it, on Facebook. So you go to the BFM Facebook and it will be live. It's something called Facebook Live. I think it's new to the kinds of functions that Facebook has on its site. So try that if you're at home or anywhere you are.
Not while you're driving.
Well, not while you're driving. I think it would be rather distracting because I'm expecting this to be a really hot grill.
Yeah, me too. Lots to discuss with Tan Sri Shahrir. Views on the current political and economic climate at the moment. Thoughts about how, the by-elections and how it could affect businesses in the area. So stay tuned for The Breakfast Grill coming up in about 20 minutes or so. Tan Sri Shahrir Samad, chairman of the BN Backbenchers Club. Bank Negara has established a financial technology enabler group which will formulate and enhance regulatory policies to facilitate the adoption of technological innovations in the Malaysian financial industry. So to help facilitate fintech.
And this follows what Chairman of CIMB Nazir Razak said yesterday about how he is all for disruptive technology, but not necessarily destructive competition in technology. And I'm happy about it as well. I want to look forward to the day where I can earn higher interest on my deposits or I can get cheaper loans, because right now there is a middle person, right? Middleman who takes away a little bit of that layer of that margins away and therefore make it more expensive for borrowers and cheaper for savers.
Okay, so I'm a little unclear as to where the boundaries lie with fintech, because fintech is such a huge, wide-ranging term. It can be anything from, you know, disruptive technology within the payment system, P2P lending, you know, crowdfunding, etc. So where does that fall? Is that Bank Negara? Is it SC? It's a bit confusing for me.
Yeah, I guess it's going to... let's hope it's not going to be a turf war. But if you're implying a turf war, I think they can sit down like mature adults and talk it out, right? Because I think you're right. This P2P thing is an overlap between Bank Negara and the Securities Commission. But the important thing is that it is happening. Mm. And this kind of disruption also has happened in the past, although not in such an intense way. Because when you look at the development of, say, the bond market, a lot of people were questioning at a time whether this would take away the loans business of the banks. But it didn't, because the banks got in on the game, right? The banks started issuing advice to bond issuers. And there are others, like in the telcos industry, telcos were giving up voice calls for data,
right?
Which is happening right now. And what about the newspaper subscribers who are changing the business model from a print ad-based model to one of an online subscription model? I think this kind of thing happens all the time, and the main beneficiaries are us.
Can I just ask if you're concerned about over-regulation of the fintech industry? Now, we often speak to fintech players on The Breakfast Grill, and one of the key concerns that they have is that regulation doesn't stifle innovation.
Yeah, I think that the kind of semantics that are being used by Bank Negara is great. It's called the Financial Technology Enabler Group.
I like
right?
that word,
It's
yes.
enabling rather than calling it a regulation. But I guess from SC's viewpoint, they have come up with rules for crowdfunding just to protect investors. The same kind of regulation also exists in the United States, where the crowdfunding and like Kickstarter projects and all that started over there. They have laws for that to protect investors.
I mean, I wonder though, you know, you mentioned, Julian, that the winners are always going to be the consumers. And I'm wondering if that's just part of the rhetoric, I mean, the propaganda of these disruptive technologies. We see, though, they are losers. And sometimes it could be the consumer in the long run. We see it with the media, for instance, a lot of the online portals. The old media funded good journalism. A lot of the new media is, you know, really tight, you know, and they have to be nimble. They're financially, they're very constrained. And, you know, journalists have had to do multiple jobs. And this has had a consequence for the quality of journalism, too. So I think there's a downside in the media when it comes to things like, you know, ride-sharing apps. Mm-hmm. There's extraordinary controls now on taxi drivers. What promoters will say is that drivers can come in at will. There's like, all this flexibility. But when you look at the incentive systems, they actually are quite draconian and they shift quite rapidly. And we talked about this once before, Melissa. You know, if week on week, the change...
the shifting goalposts.
Goalposts for performance, because incentives are crucial to the way in which people earn money. So there is actually a downside because the workers, I mean, in this case, the taxi drivers are also, at the end of the day, consumers.
I think at the end of the day, you're going to vote with your money as to what works and what doesn't. The market model is already there to tell you that the current taxi system actually doesn't work, and Uber and Grab do. Also, if you're afraid of these this new disruptive technologies becoming monopolies, I think the internet is so good at you know, offering things that are new. I mean, in the past, you saw you know, ICQ, and you saw Messenger, right? Was that Hotmail, which was
Yahoo.
I could be wrong about this, but it was subsequently acquired by Microsoft, right? But this was then replaced by other things and new kinds of Friendster, for instance, is now dead, replaced by
MySpace.
Facebook. You know, MySpace is no longer there. So monopolistic scenarios are really hard to sustain in an internet era, I think.
Well, you know, absolutely. I think we'd need to embrace it there. But, you know, I think we also have to keep our eyes wide open. I've been watching Downton Abbey, you know, a time in which, you know, people didn't have electricity. You have this character like, oh my God, do we have to use the electricity? Isn't it outrageous? I mean,
yeah. And then, on the phone.
And the last episode it was, you know, because I'm really way behind, the phone.
You're still on
the phone.
Season one, right?
Yeah, I am in season one. It was like the entry of all these new technologies.
Yeah. Well, speaking about disruption, an industry that doesn't want any disruption is the steel industry. The Master Builders Association Malaysia, MBAM, they voiced opposition to safeguard measures on steel products, arguing that without the free flow of imports, prices of steel bars may be uncontrollable.
So this is all about economic policy because initially, the policy was to start a steel industry to create an industrial base and to protect employment. But if it is just too costly, and this goes along the lines of proton mass, 1 MdB, etc., right? If the policy becomes too costly, really, is it worth saving the industry? And there is another headline from the Malaysian Reserve this morning about Dana Kapal being set up to, I suppose, give handouts to very hard-hit shippers. This is our taxpayers' money. How different is giving handouts to industries and corporations different from giving handouts directly to us, the consumers, so that when we spend, we prop up the economy as well, right? How different is that?
Well, we do have that in the form of those cash handouts we had, you know, the last couple of years, right? Again, and also the move on EPF, again, you know, allowing smaller contributions.
Well, Dana Kapal is asking for 2 billion. I'm not sure how much protection Mega Steel is asking for. It goes into, you know, the tens of billions, I suppose. And the GST that was collected last year was 40 billion. These are substantial amounts that are given to private entities.
Well, I have to ask though, I mean, it all kind of boils down as to whether these entities are in strategic industries. And I'm talking in air quotes here. Because, you know, when you talk about, you know, cash handouts or bailouts or whatever financial support, it almost always the reasoning is that, oh, this is a strategic industry, we can't let it fail. So is shipping considered as too strategic to fail?
And also when the money is given, what kind of scrutiny over how it's used, right? You don't want, you know, these monies to go to and then be fitted away, because there must be accountability with the money too.
When you say fitted away, do you mean that consumers have no idea how to spend their money?
No, I'm not talking about, right. I'm talking about the big boys, the companies that you mentioned.
Companies. Okay, yeah, I guess the jury is out there because in a very much larger scale, the quantitative easing was seen like a bailout for the banks over there, and they chose to save the system rather than keep to free market principles, right? They didn't want to let the banks collapse, which would mean a total economic collapse, they argue. But then again, if the prices come down to a certain level, market principles would dictate that some savvy investor would come in and give the funding to these zombie-like companies anyway, right? So is there a point of saving these companies? And also, TPPA, how does this kind of bailout and protectionism comply with the provisions of TPPA?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, this is a political decision. You know, when some companies go down, it's not that they just take the CEO down, they take workers down. And this is something that perhaps governments, subject to democratic elections and popular pressure, and I think it was true of Maas as well. I mean, the difficulties about restructuring Maas had to do with workers. I mean, these are not just workers, they're voters. And, you know, and also they hark to a particular kind of constituent, right? So they think, well, you're letting us down.
The taxpayers are voters too, right? But yeah. I guess this is all like hidden within a web of a labyrinth of bailouts and leakages that we don't really see it because it doesn't directly affect us. But when you talk about tens of billions of ringgit, it's really coming out of taxpayers who
it all
are
adds up,
directly voters. Consumers are voters. If you protect a certain industry and you make a very uncompetitive car cheaper than what it really is, then that's also coming out of your pockets.
7:57 right now, we've got Dato' Sri Dr. Zaid Hamidi and his first official visit to Japan last week, paving the way for greater cooperation in the halal industry there. So he's saying that there's much Malaysia can offer Japan in terms of expertise in producing halal goods and services, since 1 million Muslim tourists and athletes are expected to converge in Japan when Tokyo hosts the 2020 Olympics.
Now, Japan is known for its hygiene. I mean, the country of raw food, you need that standards of hygiene to really be able to consume raw food. Individually wrapped food items is something that you see so often, and, you know, state-of-the-art water closet. So what better country to bring the halal industry to? And Japan has 100,000 Muslims over there. And what's interesting, I think, about this article is also the fact that it's a kind of reverse transfer technology. We always ask Japan,
oh, look east, remember, you know, that
yeah,
policy?
To sell us their, to teach us about that technology. But now, you know, the Deputy Prime Minister is saying that we could teach you a few things about the halal industry.
Halal only appeal to Muslims in a country like Japan with 100 million or so people? 100,000 isn't very much. And so the question is, are we pitching halal only to the Muslims of Japan?
Well, you know, Japan wants to position itself as a tourist hub as well. Then they're hosting mega international events like the Olympics. They need to be able to cater to that segment of the market or the tourists that ask for halal products. It's really difficult when you go and you don't have that option, right? We've got the news bulletin coming up in just a couple of minutes. But let me tell you, on the breakfast grill, Tan Sri Sharir Samad, chairman of the BN Backbenchers Club, also MP for Johor Bahru, will be on.
And also, you can catch this live on Facebook. So go to Facebook. There's a live function there. So you'll see this streamed as we are having the interview.
There you go. All right. News is up next. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.